Hello.
Oh, thanks. Thank you very much. Can I ask probably for some water, please? Yeah, thanks. Thank you. Sorry, I don't normally do all this. It's a long interview, so.
Oh, that's okay.
Thanks. Hello.
Hi. Is that it?
Hello. Hi. Hi. It is. Yes.
Hi. It's Krista Tippett.
Hi, Krista.
Thanks.
Hi.
How's it going? Thanks for doing this.
It's Krista, isn't it? It's Krista.
Krista.
Krista. Right. Sorry.
K-R-I-S-T-A. Yeah.
Sure.
I was at a conference at Windsor Castle this past summer on with a bunch of people talking about religion and public life, and I heard you on the BBC then, and I've wanted to interview you ever since, so I'm really glad I could get you in.
It, was this where Douglas Murray and Robert Gleese were?
No.
No, maybe not,
no,
right?
There were. It was quite an eclectic gathering of, I don't know, members of the House of Lords and people lords and people working in think tanks and some religious scholars. And anyway, do you have questions of me? Would you like to hear a little bit about the show we do?
Yes, that would be helpful. And
okay.
I should apologize for being late. I'm sorry. It's just
That's all right.
London life.
Well, we'll get going. There's a lot to talk about. So, but this
right.
is a program that's on public radio stations, which is the closest thing we have to the BBC. Mm-hmm. It's not as vast and all pervasive, but it's heard. Public radio tends to be heard in this country by a variety of people, but especially people who are leaders in their communities, people who are educated, and so it's an influential medium. And over the years, I've interviewed quite an array of Muslim thinkers. I'm very interested in exploring religion from the inside as opposed to hearing from pundits and people who analyze religion from the outside. Mm-hmm. And so I think your story, as I heard you speaking when I was there and as I've read your book, is absolutely suited to what we do. And
right.
I'd love to send you some of the programs we've done with them. With Muslims, including people like Ingrid Mattson, who's the...
Oh, yes.
Met some of them? I'm sure you've come across people we've interviewed over the years.
No, Ingrid, I know about. I can send you my email details.
Yeah.
Yours, I suppose, is Krista...
Tippett. T-I-P-P-E-T-T. But we have... Okay, my producer has your email details, so...
Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
So let's go. So I'd like to talk for a while, just, you know, draw some of your story that you tell and then talk about some of the larger issues that are playing themselves out in the world now, and the larger conversation that you've become very much a part of, having written the book. Does that sound okay?
It sounds fine, yeah.
All
problematic,
right.
But let's start. Yes.
Yes, I have been steeped in this for the last few days, so I have a sense of that. It is striking when one begins to read your story. You growing up Muslim in Britain in the 1980s. There was a lot of complexity to that. Obviously, the National Front was at its peak, and yet your childhood, your early childhood, was full of diversity and contact and ease with different others. You describe yourself as sort of a Muslim choir boy. And I think that, you know, I think that there is a kind of very broad, generalized sense in the United States in particular, perhaps a stereotype, that it is globally poor and illiterate young Muslims who are prone to radicalization. But this is really not the story in Great Britain, and you are a prime example of that.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
You're right. It's not the story in Great Britain, and it's not the story in the Arab world either. Large numbers of British Muslims who become radicalized tend to come from educated middle class backgrounds. Last summer's attempted attacks on the Tiger nightclub in London was carried out by middle class medical students.
Right.
The 7/7 bombings was led by a classroom assistant who was a university graduate.
Mm-hmm.
And also in the Arab world, if you look at the research conducted by the sociologist Saadeddin Ibrahim in Egypt, he catalogues the fact that the vast majority of Muslim Brotherhood rank and file members are from a middle class, a disenchanted middle class who've moved from the villages into the cities and find it difficult to merge into suburbia. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at Osama bin Laden from Al-Qaeda. He's by no means from a poor background. Right. Ayman al-Zawahiri, his assistant, he's a pediatrician by profession. Right. I think that the leadership, or the core crust, as it were, do come from a not necessarily a wealthy background, but an educated, intelligent background. And it often happens that in places such as perhaps Lebanon and Palestine, where suicide bombings may well have been conducted by people from a poorer background, but doesn't necessarily mean that they're the only guys who are involved in these movements.
Mm-hmm. And you yourself were born and raised in Britain. You were not an immigrant. You were perhaps living in a culture that was defined by immigrants. But, you know, talk to me a little bit about your British identity and why your link to that was susceptible or vulnerable or tenuous, so that you did were captured by some of these ideas.
We have a real problem in Britain. It was the case when I was growing up, and it's still the case now, in that it's extremely difficult to define Britishness. Mm. Whereas in America, it's different. You have a very clear sense of national identity. We don't have that here. There's the Welsh issue, the Scottish issue, and the Irish issue that compounds this problem. And then bring into the mix people who arrived in Britain in the 1960s after the winding up of the British Empire in the West Indies and in India. You have a group of people who arrived here, you know, my parents' generation, initially for economic purposes, with some hope of, you know, going back, as it were, one day. And that going back never happened. So my generation, born and raised here, were confused as to where our parents stood. At home, we were exposed to one culture. At school, we were exposed to another. So Britishness was never clearly defined for my generation growing up. And that debate still continues today. The fact that our current Prime Minister, who has a Scottish background, has been most vociferous in trying to outline what it means to be British, mm-hmm. and yet to date failed to do so, indicates that problem still exists, and that Britain doesn't really have a strong national identity. And the fact that we've got, you know, communities up and down the country that live totally separate lives. I mean, in the name of multiculturalism, we've created these monocultural ghettos in Bradford, Birmingham, Burnley, parts of London, where there's no interaction between, you know, native white English communities and the children of immigrants. So it's very much a live problem here in Britain.
And I have a sense that when you first became attracted to a kind of politicized Islam, initially not necessarily extremist, but just that you know, some of the words you used to describe what you found worthy in what you were experiencing was that, you know, it sounds like it seemed to bridge some of these different mm-hmm. aspects of your identity that weren't bridged in the culture. You said it was English speaking, educated, rooted in faith.
Mm. See, when we went to mosques, when I went to mosques, mm-hmm. Most of the imams came from Pakistan, Bangladesh, India. They spoke about an Islam that was very much village-based, a folkloric Islam. It wasn't something that people like myself, born and raised here in Britain in a different cultural, social, political setup, could easily relate to. We were always given Islam in a second language, the language of our parents, Urdu, Bengali, whatever. But suddenly, when I reached my teens, there were these young people who spoke Islam in the language that I easily identified with, i.e. English. So it took me a while to cotton on to the fact that the sort of Islam they were trying to sell to people like myself was an Islam that was at odds with my parents, more Sufistic, traditional, orthodox Islam. But the English-speaking radicals were trying to promote a type of Islam that was, you know, Islamist, politicized. But against that, there was something else going on in the early 1990s here in Europe that people often forget, and that was the entire Balkan crisis.
Right.
In that between 91 and 94, you had large numbers of Muslims in Bosnia who were white, blonde, blue-eyed, being slaughtered in their thousands. And when people from, you know, Arab countries who had taken political refuge in Britain, Omar Bakri's and others, came and said to us that, look, you know, 2 hours away from London's Heathrow Airport, you've got people who are being slaughtered in their thousands, despite being European Muslims for 600 years. What chance do people like you and I, who are, you know, brown-skinned, black-haired got in the long term here in Britain. So for a 16-year-old who's not entirely comfortable in being in Britain, that message, you know, has a strong resonance.
Right. You were really galvanized by events in Bosnia, weren't you?
Certainly, yes. Mm-hmm. And I think the same thing is going on today with Iraq, with lots of young Muslims.
Right.
But most certainly Bosnia politicized me, yes.
And I think what's also important that I'd like to just hear you talk some more about is, you know, it wasn't just that you were discovering a way of thinking about Islam and about faith, but really a view of history that in some ways was very empowering, challenging and empowering.
Yes, it was a view of history which was empowering, but at the same time, it was a view that was very simplistic, looking back. And that it was, you know, like, I think Marx in his, and Engels in the Communist Manifesto, start by saying that the history of all societies hitherto has been a history of class struggle. In other words, them and us.
Right.
Similarly, the kind of history that I was understanding while being, you know, beside people who had an extremist worldview was very much the same thing, that all history is a history of struggle between good and evil and them and us. And the good in this case tended to be Muslims by and large, and evil everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So it was looking at the world through that prism, and everything started to make sense when you looked at the world through that set of spectacles, that the entire world was somehow out there to undermine Muslims. There was a global conspiracy against Muslims, Freemasons, Jews, Americans, everybody but Muslims themselves. It was blaming the other constantly throughout history and in today's world. And it's a very powerful grip on one's mind, and it, you know, in my case, it took years to shed that influence.
I mean, a word that was very important to you, a concept, was this of this the global Islamic community of the Ummah, right?
Mm.
And
which is a big lie.
It's a big lie, right?
Yeah, because I mean, historically, it never existed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even if you take it back to its earliest stages, when the Prophet Muhammad talked about the Ummah when he was in Medina, his Ummah consisted of the local non-believing polytheists and also the Jews who were in Medina, and also the Muslims. So there was no such, you know, exclusive notion of being a Muslim community that was set apart from everybody else. So at its archetypal form, it was inclusive of others. Throughout history, there are different Muslim ummas, you know, so
right.
You look at the Indonesians, the Africans, the Chinese, the Spaniards, the Arabs, the Indians, they were always distinctly different. But somehow here in the West, especially here in Britain or by extension Europe, there's this mythical understanding that there's this global Muslim ummah that's somehow united against the rest of the world. You only have to go to Saudi Arabia, and I document this in my book,
the
horrific racist treatment that black Muslims receive in Saudi Arabia, especially in parts like Jeddah and Karantina. I mean, seeing that woke me up to this, you know, lie that we were sold in our teens here in Britain, that we were somehow not part of mainstream society here in the West, and we weren't Westerners, but we were somehow part of this, you know, global movement called the Ummah, which, you know, it's just a total myth.
But, you know, the truth is that, as you say, it has not been an uncomplicated thing for Muslims to be part of the glow of mainstream British culture, right? And I mean, another piece of this, and I actually don't think we've grappled with this fully in the West in general, is I think that the division of the world, the superpower division of the world between West and East, kind of obscured the end of colonialism in that same period, and your generation of Muslim Britons, and your family is from India, and what was East Pakistan, Bangladesh.
Mm.
I mean, that was real, and kind of some history that people were kind of confronting for the first time in the 1990s,
mm-hmm.
and it got
mm-hmm.
mixed up in that. I mean.
Mm. I mean, the whole Indian heritage is a positive heritage for British Muslims, in that it was a heritage that wasn't, by and large, confrontational, that Indian Muslim scholars for the 400 years that Britain was in India didn't say we must now migrate to another country because somehow India had become a land of non-Islam or Darul Kufr
in
Arabic.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And there are strong theological understandings that Indian Muslim scholars developed over 400 years that, you know, British Muslims now can draw on. But somehow all that's being ignored, that there is no Indian Muslim tradition to learn from, but a constant Arabization of Western Islam is taking place as we speak. And the fact that Saudi Arabia and Saudi funds are in the vanguard of Arabizing young Muslims up and down Europe is no accident.
Mm-hmm. I mean, let's talk a little bit about your specific experiences. I'd like to hear a little bit, you know, Sayyid Qutb's milestones, which you called the Communist Manifesto of Islamism, was an important text for you. And I think for many young Muslims in those kinds of circles, you know, talk to me about what grabbed you about that. What's important about that?
Well, Qutb spent time in America in the 1950s, and there was something about Qutb that made sense for us. I guess the fact that his book was translated into English and the fact that he was in prison and he stood up to tyranny, he'd commented on the Quran, and he was seen to be a martyr because the Egyptian government hanged him in 1966. So all of that combined gave him hero status among young Muslims on college campuses in the 1990s. More to the point, young Islamists, i.e. people who believed in a politicized form of religion, you know, very postmodern, it's a new development. So Sayyid Qutb had that powerful capture over our minds. But it was reading his book I'm not suggesting for an instance that everybody who reads his book becomes a terrorist, but those who read his book and then impart those ideas to those who then attend meetings up and down Britain and, you know, Europe and Middle East and so on, are grabbed by the fact that he defined the world very much in a bipolar sense, that there was the Muslim vanguard who was over and above other Muslims. So it was very much a Marxist, Gramscian way of looking at the world. Not do you have just Muslims, but you have a vanguard Muslim group over and above everybody else who leads the Muslim community into confronting the West, into confronting the non-believing world. And he compounded the Darul Islam, the world of Islam, the Darul Kufr, the world of non-believer hypothesis, to its maximum. And I think his power lay in the fact that he even argued that the vast majority of Muslim governments were non-Muslim, that they came from what he called Jahiliyyah. In other
words, you were not just opposing the West. I mean, this worldview had a lot to conquer in the Muslim world as well.
Well, this is the key, and this is where I think most non-Muslims, including most Americans, simply don't understand the stakes that we're playing for here, in that this phenomena, whatever you want to call it, political Islam, extremism, Al-Qaeda worldview, Wahhabism, whatever you want to call it, it threatens Muslims first and foremost before it goes out to try to undermine the West. Yes. And Sayyid Qutb's worldview was very much based on the fact that we've got to overthrow the Egyptian regime and bring about a holier-than-thou state, which he called an Islamic state, in itself a myth. But that's what he called for. And then that state would go out and attack and undermine Israel and then, you know, the Americans. And then, you know, I mean, he laid it out. And other groups that influenced him have put this down in writing in their constitution. So there's no surprise that there's a strong political component to this. And that's why it's not a cliche to say that the West and normal Muslims, moderate Muslims, have common cause in trying to defeat this extremist mindset. Because it threatens both of us.
Right. And over the years, I've spoken with a number of people who, and not just Muslims, who, as young people, that, you know, that tends to be the rule, became drawn into extremist movements. And, you know, one of the things they've talked about to me is the intoxication and the power that comes with that, that meets something in adolescence and young adulthood where one's identity is fragile, where one is looking for a cause and an identity. Was that your experience too? I mean, could you talk about the appeal of this idea to you at that point in your life? And in this milieu, you really describe British universities and schools where these kinds of ideas were everywhere, right?
Among activist Muslims, and there were plenty of Muslims who got on with their lives and went and did normal things, but those who became part of the activist hub, affiliated by and large with either Islamists or Saudi Wahhabists or Indian Deobandis, there are various traditions, but the first two are more problematic than the third one. Yes, you're right, it's about identity, and that's only attractive to us because we didn't have a strong identity to start off with. So when in that void, Islamists come onto the scene and say that, hey, you're not just Muslim, you're more than being an ordinary Muslim, you're a true Muslim with a capital T and a capital M, and your allegiance lies to the global ummah. But alongside that, they brought on board ideas of elitism and secrecy and global power. So being part of this movement meant that you were several cuts above ordinary Muslims. You know, you're by and large superior to non-Muslims, but of course even among Muslims you were seen to be several cuts above others. But also, the group I was with for over 2 years was a very secretive movement that had global sales.
And this is Hizbut Tahrir?
Yes.
Right, which tends to be referred to in British newspapers as HT, so we can do that as well, I think.
Yes. HT was very secretive, very elitist. Mm-hmm. So you get that extra buzz of, trying to keep global secrets and this elite movement that was always full of people who are accountants, doctors, lawyers. So you were mixing with the upper crust of society, but at the same time having a worldview that was different from most normal people and planning something, i.e. an Islamist state in the Middle East that would be expansionist and totalitarian. But of course at the time we didn't see it as totalitarian, we saw it as a true faith-based state, which of course is a misnomer.
Right. One journalist wrote in The Guardian... the world you describe of this student activism is full of drama and factions. And, one journalist wrote in The Guardian, set aside the Muslim names of the people involved and the names of their organizations, and it's a typical tale of student politics. Endless argument, rabble-rousing, leafleting, wildly idealistic theorizing, and some dirty tactics in committee meetings. And I have to say, I had that impression as well, that in some sense this was a student movement like many student movements. But I want to ask you, what has changed, what has ratcheted up when religion in general and Islam in particular, radicalized Islam, is in that mix?
Yes, I know the article you refer to, and I know the journalist you refer to, and he's right in his assertion. And he's right because Islamism as a political ideology, and I'm not talking about Islam the faith, but the ideology here, was influenced directly by Marxism. So it's no surprise that you find those very same tactics being employed by Islamists on university campuses. But what's different, and what white liberal Westerners tend not to understand, especially here in Britain, because we're such a secular society, and there's no sense of God in the public domain, and because they've done away with Christianity, they then find it difficult to understand what drives people who aren't just politically motivated, but as you correctly identify, when religion is then thrown into the mix. It's not about activism to bring about a better tomorrow or a communist state in which everyone's equal, but it's about doing this in the name of God and doing this not only just for this world, but having a better afterlife. Mm-hmm. So what would be seen as acting ethically for bringing about a better world on the far left, in Islamist circles that becomes compounded with a sense of religion, a sense of superiority over the inferior non-believer, and also looking forward to an afterlife in which if you don't do what they suggest that you must do, you're actually brought to account and, in their world, sent to hell for not standing up for God and establishing what they call an Islamic state in this world. So there's this fear factor put into this, that you're actually carrying out religious obligations, and the failure to do so means eternal damnation in the hereafter.
Right, it's a cosmic fear.
So it's actually much, much powerful.
Yes.
Sorry, but it's quite powerful.
All right, here's something else I think in the United States... people tend to think about Al-Qaeda, just Al-Qaeda or Wahhabism, as the center of the greatest threat. The world you describe is much more diverse and varied and chaotic. I do wonder, where was Wahhabism in the mix for you? Does the existence, again, of this very organized global movement like Al-Qaeda also ratchet up that picture even more?
Al-Qaeda came on the scene much later. Mm-hmm. Before Al-Qaeda, there was, as you currently identify, a Wahhabist mindset. And I, for a second, don't want to imply that all Wahhabis are terrorists. They're not. But most terrorists tend to share a Wahhabi theology. So throughout the 1990s, 80s, there was this literalist reading of scripture, and you find this widespread not just in Saudi Arabia, but every Muslim community that succumbed to Saudi influences. And that's the danger, that most Islamists politically may well lean towards creating this utopian state, but theologically they're very much Saudi-based or Wahhabism-based. So it's a combination of Saudi-Wahhabi theology based with revolutionary Islamist politics that produces the bastard child, which is Islamism, that that Al-Qaeda aspire towards. So many of the arguments that Islamist organizations were putting out in the 1990s, say, for example, that Arab oil, or Saudi oil to be more precise, is a possession of the global Muslim ummah, or the global Muslim community. I mean, that comes straight out of Karl Marx's belief in the means of distribution and owning the means of distribution, all the rest of it. But it was organizations such as HT that were advocating that in the late 80s and early 1990s. Bin Laden adopted that argument in 1997 and put it out there. So this has been boiling in the Muslim world for the last 30, 40 years, the marrying in the 1960s when the Saudi government gave refuge to people who the Egyptian government was persecuting. And then slowly, you know, the whole Afghan episode and the Saudi exporting of Wahhabism, and then marrying that up with conservative reactionary Islamism, and then you have what we have today, Al-Qaeda.
Right.
But it must be said that Al-Qaeda is just a name. It's really a mindset that we must be tackling, literalist, rejectionist, Islamist worldview, and not necessarily Al-Qaeda as an organization, because that can become defunct, but those ideas still remain. So it's not a war on terror, as the American government has gone out of its way to suggest, but it's actually a battle of ideas.
Hmm. And my sense is that although you were deeply involved and more involved and eventually completely estranged from your family because of this, it was when you came very, very close to terror, when you, in fact, were kind of on the periphery of a murder, that you personally began to shrink back from this.
Yes, I mean, you remind me of something that's very powerful. I was part of HT, and I just thought talking about jihad or unwarranted killing in the Middle East or calling for the army of a future caliph going into Bosnia, I mean, all that seemed like abstract rhetoric that might be relevant to the Middle East. Not for a moment did I think that once that voice was put out there, once those ideas were implanted in people's minds, compounded with, you know, the them and us mentality that non-Muslims were inferior and jihad could be conducted by anyone and everyone willy-nilly, that someone somewhere would actually act on that and act on my own doorstep, on my in my own college campus. So seeing Muslims shout, you know, the sort of slogans you hear in Palestine or in Kashmir, here in London, and then seeing other Muslims literally take up weapons in the name of faith, I mean, forced me, as you correctly say, to stand back and say, well, what's going on here? And and to see a dead body in front of one's eyes as a result of those ideas being advocated. I mean, you've got to take responsibility and say, yes, you know, organizations such as HT may not pull the trigger, and they don't. I'm not suggesting they're a murderous organization for a minute, but they create an environment in which it makes it easier for others to do so. And so I saw that happen quite early on, and therefore slowly started to move back.
And that was the murder of a Nigerian Christian by one of a Muslim who was part of the circles in which you were living and working.
Yes.
I was also really struck by you. You know,
you
were close to people who did actually fall off that cliff, who became terrorists. Asif Hanif, who became the first British suicide bomber in Tel Aviv in 2003. And the way you described him as a human being is you said he was a teddy bear of a guy, that he was generous and kind and selfless and committed.
He was. And this is another point that many of us fail to comprehend, that suicide bombers aren't some evil human beings walking in our midst. They're normal, caring individuals. And it's that normality and that sense of being caring, when exploited by others, that turns them into being suicide bombers. They care passionately for their causes. They're sincere individuals. We might not like to hear this, but that's what they are.
Right, you said his very selflessness was the quality that led him to be the person who would strap bombs onto his body.
Yes, because he didn't care for his own self, and he cared for the Palestinian cause and for Palestinians in their repression as he saw them in Syria and also in the Palestinian territories. His mistake was to think that by killing himself he was advancing their cause. He wasn't. He was doing them a disservice. But it was that selflessness that he could give up his own life in order to serve them.
Mm. I wonder how that memory, you know, mobilizes you now. I mean, there's always a grief when someone dies, when someone we know dies, but to have someone who you clearly had such affection for and even admiration, to have that as part of your experience.
It brings it home for you. It takes it beyond media headlines and newspaper clichés that these are real, caring human beings. Mm-hmm. And it's those qualities that we must continue to foster in order to make them understand that by being selfless and killing themselves, they don't advance the cause of the Palestinians one iota. In fact, if anything, it's done them a disservice. Israel's put up this huge wall. There's there's very little interaction between Israelis and Palestinians. And Israel's response has been strongly recriminatory every time there's a suicide bombing that goes off. So it doesn't do them any favours. And it's not just a strategic thing. It's morally wrong. It's disgusting. You don't take your own life to sort of kill other people. But all of that said, we must be honest about this, that there is a sense of real persecution and powerlessness on the part of people who go and become suicide bombers. They fail to understand other ways of addressing this issue, be it parliamentary democracy, be it lobbying, be it creating public awareness, be it engaging in the political process, or they've deliberately disavowed that route and gone down the route of violence. Whatever it is, that mindset needs to be opened up and explored and rejected. Right now, throughout the West, we're steering away from trying to understand what is the mindset that leads people to becoming suicide bombers. Right. And we're focusing all our energies in trying to prevent people from committing the act. So in British government circles, the entire focus is on violent extremism, without understanding it's actually extremism that you've got to deal with in order to prevent violence.
Or that the violence comes later.
Hmm. Well, exactly, mm-hmm. Yes.
And, you know, you have been compared by some to figures like Ayaan Hirsi Ali. Some have experienced your book and your public speaking as becoming an apologist for the West and kind of a blanket critic of Muslim activism. I see a very important difference between the path you've taken and that of someone like Ayaan Hirsi Ali, in that your path out of Islamic extremism was into a deepened Islamic spirituality.
Precisely. Ayaan Hirsi Ali was here in London recently, and we both had a public debate, and we disagree fundamentally. Those who think that Ayaan and I have anything in common just don't understand the nature of the debate we're involved in. Rejecting Islamism, the political ideology, doesn't mean you reject a spiritual tradition of 1400 years. Ayaan has thrown the baby out with the bathwater. She doesn't see the difference between the ideology and the faith. And I've got no qualms in saying for a moment that her grasp of Islam and Muslim issues has been tainted by her experiences in Africa. Mm-hmm. My experiences are different. I was born and raised in the West. I am a Westerner. Western tradition is my tradition. The Renaissance that came about in Europe came about directly as a result of the contribution Muslim philosophers such as Averroes and Avicenna made. My forefathers preserved Greek heritage that was then bequeathed to the West. So I'm not an apologist for the West, since I am myself a Westerner. So it's bizarre for people on the far left to make that criticism. And for my community, especially the Muslim community, I want the very best for my community. I'm not hammering my community because I want them to hunker in and avoid debate and discussion. We can't move forward as a community unless we openly have a discussion about issues that trouble fellow Westerners. And my faith is very much based on the fact that here in the West, Western Muslims, Americans, Brits, Spaniards, French, we can fix it here among ourselves before we turn on the Muslim East and suggest, look, issues such as stoning the adulterer, amputating the arm of a thief, or as happened recently in Saudi Arabia, the flogging of a gang rape victim, right, those are barbaric practices. They're, I mean, they're mentioned in Leviticus in the Old Testament. The Prophet Muhammad adopted those practices based on what he saw around him in the Jewish community in Medina. And in today's world, those practices have no place. Unless we in the West, Western Muslims, stand up and make that case, I'm afraid that in the long term, it's going to be, we're going to have more Ayaan Hirsi Alis and more Salman Rushdies, in which people continue to reject their Islamic faith under being battered from the Western liberal intelligentsia. So for me, it's about bridging that gap and producing a generation of young, confident, dynamic, articulate Muslims who can stand up for themselves in the West and then go back into the Muslim East and shine a beacon of hope and say, look, we've fixed it in the East, in the West, right, we're equally Muslim, and you too can do the same.
Hmm. So talk to me a little bit about what you discovered spiritually. Now, you were raised by a father who was very influenced by Sufi tradition. And in a sense, you know, that is one of the traditions that you have come back to appreciating and embracing. But tell me what you discovered that really did change your life at this later point as an adult, what you discovered in Islam.
Much of this goes back, I must say, to American Muslim influences.
And that's very interesting.
Yeah, and that you've got fascinating scholars such as Imam Hamza Yusuf Hansen from California, yes, who I was exposed to here in Britain in the late 1990s. And in him and in others, I saw Muslims who are Westerners, who are American, who are English-speaking, who are intelligent, deeply erudite, and connected to a sense of prophetic Islam, connecting themselves right back to the Prophet Muhammad. And they embodied that persona of compassion, of justice, of love, of humanity. And it was really getting more and more sort of involved and close to people like Imam Hansen and others here in Britain that helped me intellectually come to terms with Islam, away from Islamism, the political ideology, and more importantly, discover a spiritual tradition that sits comfortably with other spiritual traditions and looking at human beings as just that, as fellow human beings. Mm. And it's not our duty to judge others, and ultimately it's them and their relationship with God. Sufi truths these are universal truths that chime across all religions. And it's having that inner sense of relationship with God that then manifests in your actions on the outside that I personally found worked for me. I'm not suggesting this as a panacea for everyone, but it's something that worked for me, and it very much sat at home with my parents and my family and friends.
I recently met Sheikh Hamza Yusuf for the first time and heard him speak. Right. And it was very interesting for me to read your book and to find what an influence he's been as a preacher. I knew that he was important as an Islamic preacher globally, but especially for British Muslims. You know, he's interesting because he is a convert to Islam, converted in early adulthood. I believe his father was a very important professor of classics, and Hamza Yusuf has kind of become an important figure studying and preaching about and teaching about classical intellectual traditions in Islam.
Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it so rich, mm-hmm, in that people like him have taught people like myself, mm-hmm, that there is an inherent pluralistic tradition within Islam, mm-hmm, on which we can draw on in order to bring about a renaissance for today's Muslims without having to draw on external sources. So that's why people like Ayaan Hirsi Ali have got it wrong in that they've neglected classical Muslim tradition. And people like Imam Hamza Yusuf have got it right in that they refer rightly to an inherently pluralistic Muslim tradition and from which we can all learn.
And I wonder if you have a sense of why the North American Muslim experience is so different from the experience you had as a British Muslim. I mean, clearly there are many things we can point at, but how do you kind of explain and analyze that?
I've met several North American Muslims in very close circles of late, and my impression is that it's a combination of two things. One, that the kind of Muslim that went to America from the Muslim East is by and large different from the kind of Muslims that came to Britain and now Spain and France.
How's that?
Socioeconomic factors. Mm-hmm. You know, poorer background, less educated, more remote and rural areas were the kind of parts of the world that Muslims in Britain more or less came from. Whereas in America, I think, and by extension Canada, people who had a more educated background, middle-class background, migrated to the States. But that's not the full story. I think the fact that you have a very strong national identity, that people who, as you say, fresh off the boat, can come and sign up to something
That identity is more porous somehow.
Yeah, it's there. It's palpable.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Britain or in Europe in general, it's just not there. European Muslims don't feel European. There's a sense of rejection here. There's a constant seeing, the constantly viewing of us as the other. Whereas American Muslims are deeply patriotic and deeply proud of being American and being Muslim. Here, we don't have that. I mean, you'd be hard-pressed to find Muslims in the north of England saying that they're British Muslims. It just doesn't happen. So there's a lot to be said, I think, about America being a nation of immigrants and not having a sense of arrogant superiority within the country, at least, whereas here we have a sense that native English people have, you know, have a whole host of methods with which to decipher the other. So how you hold your knife and fork during dinner.
That happens among white British people of different classes as well.
Well, exactly. So it's divisive within white British people, and it makes it even more difficult for people who have a different kind of name, different kind of ethnic background, different history, to integrate into something that is already divisive and in many ways not so welcoming.
Hmm. I mean, I'm surprised, I'm intrigued by you, by your sense, you know, you're saying that it's different kinds of Muslims, different socioeconomic classes who've come to Britain, for example, or to the United States. I mean, when I was in Britain last summer, as those attacks happened at the Glasgow airport,
mm-hmm.
Before anything was known about that, I was at a gathering where there were quite senior politicians and policymakers, and that was one of the things people were saying. But of course, it turned out that the Muslims who were part of those attacks, as has been true in other kinds of terrorist attacks, were, you know, they were medical students. They were highly educated people who, some of whom had, you know, had deep roots in Britain. So,
No, but this is a new generation of immigrants coming. My reference was to the first generation that came in the 1960s. That was from, by and large, very remote parts of Pakistan, Bangladesh, India. And if anybody doubts that, just go and visit Bradford and see the socially conservative mindset that you have among the older generation. And it's not to disrespect them in any way, but that's just, I mean, they came from places such as Mirpur in Pakistan or Sylhet in Bangladesh. Predominantly poor, uneducated. I mean, it's not to sound derogatory, but it's just trying to make the point that coming from a very village background into a 21st century dynamic city surrounding is very difficult to adjust. And as a result, I'm not blaming them, but a new generation that's been produced, which is very uncomfortable as to where it belongs between these two extremes of modernity and insularity of the past.
So there's a different kind of foundation that new generations of North American Muslims are building on, and the foundation that Britons of your generation are building on.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly, yes. And you see that. I mean, take, for example, the large conferences you have in America among American Muslims. I think one of the motions that was passed was that the Jewish synagogues in America would twin with Muslim mosques.
Right, like the Islamic
Society. That's a phenomenal idea. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly, the ISNA conference. And that's a fascinating example from which not just Europeans, but also Arab Muslims can learn in terms of maintaining positive ties between different faiths. Try suggesting something like that to the British Muslim Council here. Almost impossible. Only last week, after 6 years of kicking and screaming, have they decided to attend Holocaust Memorial Day. Mm. I mean, that's what we're up against, a mindset that just doesn't understand the West, whereas in America, Muslims have done, you know, far better.
You know, I mean, I wanted to ask you about this. There's a Pew Global Attitudes poll in 2006 that showed that Muslims in Britain are the most anti-Western in Europe. Now, I mean, I always take poll results with a grain of salt. They don't tell us the whole story. There's a lot that's missing. No, yes. But, you know,
they're often doctored as well.
Well, they're problematic. But, you know, one thing that it found is that British Muslims, a significant majority of British Muslims, view Westerners as selfish, arrogant, greedy, and immoral. That only 32% of British Muslims have a favorable opinion of Jews, compared with 71% of French Muslims, which is quite stunning to me. Now, you also describe this anti-Semitic strain to radicalized Islam from your experiences. I mean, explain that to me. Where does that come from and what's it about?
It's a difficult one to talk about, I guess, because in different countries it manifests differently. In Morocco, for example, Jewish people have very good ties with native Moroccans and the native Moroccans themselves. But I think the Arab-Israeli conflict makes it very difficult for Muslims here in Britain to get beyond that conflict and to see Jewish people as that, Jewish people. The State of Israel is a political development, and we can discuss that and debate that till the cows come home. But ultimately, we're dealing with people here in Britain who are Jewish, who now feel that on Saturday mornings when they go to the synagogue, they need a security and police protection to do that in large sections of Britain. I mean, that's just unacceptable, but that's what's going on. There's a sense here among, and it's difficult to say if that's an attitude shared across the Muslim community. And most mosque imams and others have good ties with people of other faiths, but those ties could be better and deeper. It's difficult for me to comment on this because, as I said, even the Muslim Council of Britain is just. Last week said it'll commemorate Holocaust Memorial Day, but I put a lot of the blame on what was going on here in the 1990s, in that the communal discourse of the British Muslim community was not just hijacked but dominated by people who are Arab, who are political asylum seekers, and who came to Britain because they had real problems with their regimes, and they blamed Israel for everything. So they sort of put down this idea across young Muslim communities at universities that somehow Jews were to blame for all the problems of the world. And again, I think there is an inherent English anti-Semitism here in Britain, which makes it quite easy for Muslims to harbour such views without being seen to be too repulsive. It's a good marrying up of English anti-Semitism, which is very much hush-hush, which is still out there, but
yes,
not spoken
discreet,
about openly.
Isn't it?
It's there. You feel it. It's out there. And then that's married up with that being very vocal from among certain sections of the Muslim community. But it must be said, I mean, post-7/7, the most anti-Semitic groups, HD among them, have toned down their anti-Semitism. Now, whether it's a question of strategy or principled change, it remains to be seen.
Now, with 7/7, you're referring to the July 7th terrorist attacks in 2004, which I believe...
2005.
2005, was it?
Yes.
52 people killed, the largest... attack like that on British soil since the war. I wonder how, and this all happened after you had left HT, after you, far beyond the period of you being radicalized. How has that imprinted British society and the development of, you know, this discussion, all of the aspects of what we're discussing about these dynamics in British society?
Well, 7/7 was a huge wake-up call to Britain. Prior to 7/7, everybody more or less was quite content to allow for Muslim separatism, extremist organisations to quite openly discuss whether they were British or whether they were Muslim, and then decide in a conference of about 10,000 people here in London that they were Muslim and just Muslim, and Britishness had nothing to do with them. Very deep separatism was developing here in Britain, and it was considered acceptable because it was all done in the name of multiculturalism, that it's acceptable to have difference at that level. So it was multiculturalism gone wild, and then suddenly we needed something as horrible as 7/7 to remind us that you allow people to develop in an underworld in which ideas of parliamentary democracy, of liberalism, of secularism have no meaning, then people resort to these ugly means to express their grievances. So since 7/7, there have been several initiatives to try to come to terms with what it is in British society that allows for an underclass to develop that's totally disconnected to the mainstream. But, you know, only last night I was on a television programme with a British MP by the name of Diane Abbott, and people like her and others continue to perpetuate the myth that there's nothing wrong, it's just foreign policy, you fix foreign policy and all will be well. Mm. So on the one hand, you've got that extreme that refuses to acknowledge the fact that multiculturalism has been conducted wrongly and we've made mistakes and we need to correct those. And on the other extreme, you've got the far right that are suggesting the whole problem is to do with immigration. So between these two extremes, I think there are some of us who are trying to carve out a middle path where to say that, yes, there are problems within the Muslim community that need to be addressed, you know, scriptural, social, political, economic, and there are problems with the mainstream, you know, cultural snobbery,
right.
Arrogance, a sense of history that needs readdressing. You know, so it's a two-way street. So we're in the middle of that discussion as a nation, I think, but the jury's out really as to where we'll end up.
I wonder if you'd say some more about why multiculturalism is such a problematic and loaded word in British culture right now. You know, the word itself doesn't translate as a problem into an American ear, but it really, I mean, what for you about the British experience or definition of multiculturalism that evolved contributed to the radicalized student atmosphere that you became part of?
See, the British chief rabbi, Sir Jonathan Sacks, has been speaking out against multiculturalism recently, as have been, you know, the Archbishop of York, John Santamu, and Trevor Phillips, who's the head of the Commission for Racial Equality. Lots of people have been, and they're all, you know, not usual suspects.
No.
But the chief rabbi makes a very important point here when he says that he uses the metaphor of a hotel and the metaphor of a country house, where in a country house people are guests. You know, you're welcome as an outsider, you're a guest. In a hotel, you're a visitor. You come in, you have your separate rooms, you occasionally meet in the lobby area, but by and large, you then you know, pay your taxes, as it were, and you check out. But he wants to refer to society as a home, and you know, a home we build together. And I identify with that because in Britain we've got multiculturalism, which is very much like a hotel, in which everyone just comes, does their own thing, pays their taxes and gets on with life. And there's no interaction. Whereas if we view society as a home in which we all have a stake, which we're responsible for trying to build together, I think it's a different kind of Britain. Multiculturalism as an idea is a noble idea. And I'm a product of multiculturalism. I went to a multicultural school.
Right.
But my problem with that is when in the name of a noble idea, we create monocultural ghettos in which we're quite happy to translate and interpret for people to understand how to give up smoking rather than teach them English. We're quite happy to allow for people in those monocultural ghettos in Bradford or Birmingham to undergo marital rape or domestic abuse and everything else that comes with it, because it's what happens in their community. And we haven't empowered them with the English language to go and complain to the local police or seek refuge with social services simply because we think it's you know, it's too politically sensitive for us to get involved in. For me, that's a deep sense of inherent racism in which we think it's other people's problems. Okay, that's how they live. Let's not talk about it. If you know, equal rights for men and women is good enough for white Westerners, it's good enough for the rest of the world. And it's not neoconservative to suggest that these are universal human rights and they should be put out there and enjoyed by all of humanity and not by certain privileged sections. So I come to multiculturalism as someone who's been born and raised in multicultural Britain and simply think that it's had its day and we now need to move on as a confident society to genuine pluralistic discourse, not dominated by this constant fear of allowing people to live as they want to live.
You know, something you mentioned a minute ago about how God is absolutely has been taken completely out of the public sphere in Britain. It seems to me a very fascinating dynamic now is how Muslims in Britain, who are now the second largest religious group, now, of course, almost everyone in Britain is Anglican. It's a small percentage. But and yet Muslims Muslims are important and influential in good ways and bad, disproportionate to their numbers, right, in Britain. And so what's fascinating is how Islam and British Muslims may now be forcing or intensifying a cultural reevaluation throughout British society of the place of religion in culture and public life.
You're absolutely right, and that's why there's such a feisty defense of atheism suddenly in Britain.
Right.
You've got people like Christopher Hitchens writing that book.
I keep reminding people that Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins are both British. But
yeah, well, what do people think?
They're huge here. But
right, well, actually, the Brits, and they come against that background of a strong,
deeply secular, progressive left, right?
Yeah, well, exactly, a fundamentalist atheist left. In that, it's amazing that people like Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and others, especially Hitchens, I think, the name he gave his book was a direct defiance of the Muslim ritual prayer opening. God is not great, because we say God is great. Mm-hmm. So that's very interesting. And, you know, he takes several pops at Muslims in his book. Martin Amis, one of our top writers, has gone on the record recently trying to assert that tradition of a God-free society. Yes, Muslims, I think, rightly have brought God and faith back into the public domain, but it's a sensitive issue, and it's important to get this one right and not to overdo it, because where we are as a country 300 years on from the entire sort of Reformation Renaissance experience, and it took two world wars to defend this strong liberal tradition. And I don't advocate the mixing of religion and politics in the public domain. But at the same time, people who have faith-based convictions shouldn't be shut out of the public debate. Just as you have Christian Democrats in Central Europe, we can have Muslim Democrats in Western Europe who, much like Tony Blair, who derived his passion and sense of justice for politics based on his understanding of scripture, but without shoving it down people's throats.
Well, he kept it almost very secret and compartmentalized, or at least out of the limelight while he was prime minister.
Yes, but that's because he was advised by people like Alistair Campbell, who said, we don't do God. Mm-hmm. That's part of the problem, I think, that Muslims here feel that their sense of identity when it comes to religion is shunned upon because they can't express themselves for what they are, what we are, same as in France. But in America, that's another crucial difference, in that God is out there in the public domain. So most Americans understand what it means to worship the same God.
Not always uncontroversially, but there's a sense that it's done, that we do God sometimes.
Yeah, but your presidents repeatedly say, God bless America. Can you imagine our prime minister saying, God bless Britain? People would freak out.
And, you know, I want to ask you about this, because at this conference I was at Windsor Castle last summer, I did have a sense there were some people there from think tanks and organizations that seemed to be mostly being led by younger people, you know, for the most part British Anglicans and Catholics. But what they were saying to me, one of the people, I'm trying to think of the name of the think tank. Theos or, I don't know.
Civitas?
It wasn't Civitas. Anyway, he was telling me that they'd been doing studies. This person who was quite young, I would say he was in his early 30s, that they have been doing studies, and they really saw a big difference between the generations on this. And not necessarily that younger generations of Britons are ready to wear their religion on their sleeve, but that they don't have some of the baggage. He said, for example, that there was a real generational break, that older Britons were very sympathetic to, for example, the kind of Christopher Hitchens approach to religion or Richard Dawkins, and that younger Britons were just, you know, didn't find it very interesting. Do you think there's a generational openness across British culture to having a different kind of conversation?
Younger people tend to be more open, yes, because in their DNA they don't have that anti-Muslim psyche that an older generation has. Yes, I mean, people like Dawkins and Hitchens can say that they're atheists, you know, till they go blue in the face, but they harbour an Anglican worldview. They harbour a Christian sense of right and wrong. They were, by and large, perhaps, you know, they're the grandchildren of Christians, and there's something in, I mean, their approach to seeing a church in the English countryside would be different from my approach to seeing a church in the countryside. They'd identify with that more than I would. But there's the new generation of people I meet at universities now, you know, white Brits, brown Brits, whatever, Muslims, non-Muslims. You're right, they are more free from the cultural baggage of Christianity or from other religions. And that's a void. The question is, will fill that void in 15, 20 years' time?
Right.
Yes, mm-hmm. it's acceptance to anything and everything. When you don't have any beliefs, when you have no moral guidance, when there's a total moral vacuum, there's a real danger as to what will fill that. And I think the worry for many people here on the right is that they somehow think that Islam's going to fill that and Europe will become Eurabia, that horrible word coined by people in the United States. But I'm not sure if that's the case, because what they're opposed to, many, many young people, is not just Christianity, but they're opposed to practices that they see as abhorrent within all religions. So to argue that somehow Islam's going to fill that, I think it's being too ambitious.
I wonder, you are very... have been very critical, and yourself have been criticized for pointing at you know, kind of a wild and very active, almost vibrant world of many, many different kinds of politicized Islamic groups, themselves not necessarily terrorist, but perhaps inclining some young people to that. But I also sense, as I read some of what you've been saying recently and look at your book, that you do see in the very diversity of the Muslim, the varied spectrum of the Muslim community in Britain, you do also see that as a source of hope. And you point to that it is not one thing to be Muslim in Britain and British.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, Islam has never been, will never be a monolithic entity. It's always been diverse. It's the attempt by people who have a politicized version of Islam post-1960s to impose their brand of Islam on everybody else that vexes me and so many other people. That, you know, you can go and practice your politicized Islam and go and call for your destruction of Israel and go and call for your confrontation with the West, and you go deal with it, but don't go and do that in the name of my faith and don't expect me to back you because you're somehow a fellow believer. I'm sorry, that's not going to happen. My allegiances lie with... I think it was Booker T. Washington, the great American civil rights campaigner, who said, you know, cast down your buckets where you are. We're here and we will cast down our buckets here in the West. Hmm. And we're not going anywhere. So those guys who want to somehow distract us from being where we are and working for the common good of all human beings in the West and just concentrate on the Arab-Israeli conflict or to just concentrate on the jihad in, I don't know, Chechnya or Afghanistan, wherever they've identified the latest jihad. Sorry, guys, that's not our agenda. You know, we belong here. What we can do for all human beings, whether they're Sudanese in Darfur or whether they're people who are struck by the cyclone in Bangladesh recently, we'll try our best to help. But don't come bringing on this, you know, faith-based agenda on all of us. But another reason why... I think that's it. Question at the outset.
Well, tell me, what are you looking at? Tell me about people or organizations or things that are happening in British culture right now, or, you know, within the Muslim community and beyond it, that do, for you, point in a good direction, that give you some hope about all of this.
I think the fact that most Muslims now are... take, for example, the recent teddy bear issue. When the whole cartoon cartoon controversy happened with the Danish newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you had Muslims, however small in number, here in Britain, protesting against that. This time round, with the teddy bear conflict, it's horrendous to even call it that, a teddy bear conflict, there have been no such protests. Most Muslims, without exception, went out there and condemned it. We had two British Muslim peers who went out there and secured that British teacher's release. Those are positive signs. There are more and more Muslims who are becoming part and parcel of civil society. More Muslims are prepared to stand up and talk out against extremist groups.
Very interesting to me, a friend who you mention in the book, Majid Nawaz, who was someone who remained radicalized after you left, then ended up in prison in Egypt because of his membership in HD, and has now emerged as a real... Well, he's kind of... He's come out and... I see him as a kind of ally and a partner of you, in a sense.
I mean, he's my closest friend.
Is he?
We get on really well, yes.
And I've been listening to him also as I've been preparing to speak to you. And
he's a great guy. He's now mm-hmm. in Denmark, as we speak, trying to undo the damage that he did in Denmark in the 1990s, because HT sent him out there to recruit and set up, and he did. So he's out there now trying to undo that damage. And there are others. There are several others who have just come out of several extremist groups. So you're right to identify that as hope, that if we can get more people out and then get these people to challenge that very mindset that creates extremism and then terrorism, then you know our lives would have been successful. But I don't buy that argument that often people put my way, that somehow terrorism and extremism are distinctly different and Islamism and jihadism must always be separated. I mean, Francis Fukuyama has been recently talking about this. At one level, I see where they're coming from, but you can't name me a single jihadist movement anywhere in the world that came out without Islamism preceding it.
Okay.
Jihadists, by and large, are disgruntled Islamists who've given up on the democratic process, who've thought that they can't take over what they want to take over, you know, through the ballot box, so they just resort to taking up weapons. So you know, it's Islamism that produced jihadism. Here, 7/7 was carried out by people who had strong links to Al-Muhajirun. We've got to ask ourselves, who produced Al-Muhajirun? It was HT. And in the current spin of things, we often get away from understanding the fact that it was the Muslim Brotherhood that produced the people that then went and killed Anwar Sadat. And today, the people who are in prison in Egypt, who Majid Nawaz met, will confirm to you the fact that they were all disgruntled Muslim Brotherhood people.
So part of, I mean, I did write down a sentence in your book. You said even today, a primary reason for Western failure in the war on terror is an innate inability to understand the Islamist psyche. So this is one thing you would want policymakers in the West to be attentive to. And what else? What else about the psyche? I mean, we've been talking about this for an hour. What else do you want to say needs attention and understanding that simply escapes a lot of the public discussion that we now have?
For most policymakers and for most government personnel, their concern is, you know, when's the next bomb going to go off and how are we going to prevent that from happening? As long as we're secure, who cares what's going on among the minutiae details of Muslim communal discourse? And for me, that's a problem, because it's what we said earlier. Unless you understand extremism, you won't understand where the violence comes from. You can't just concentrate on violent extremism without understanding extremism.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also the other factor that, you know, most of our politicians here in Britain, at least, are from the 1960s generation, you know, the whole free society and the sexual revolution and, you know, taking cocaine, all the rest of it. They're godless. You know, most of them don't understand what it means to have faith. And when you don't understand what it means to be a Christian in your own tradition and what the power of the belief in an afterlife can do to you when perverted, you can't then possibly comprehend what is it that drives a suicide bomber who thinks by killing himself and killing others he's somehow becoming a martyr and going into an afterlife in which he's going to be rewarded. That basic fact hasn't been deeply appreciated by our policymakers here. And as a result, they just think pumping money into resources, be it socioeconomic or tweaking foreign policy, is somehow going to fix this problem. It's not. It's much deeper.
So clearly everyone, also because we live in a globalized world, people in the West, every human being today has a stake in Muslim communal discourse. And yet, you know, outsiders, non-Muslims, can't lead really or guide or even contribute to that Muslim communal discourse. I mean, how can non-Muslims, both governments and citizens, be constructive forces so that...
By engaging on key ideas, mm-hmm. by engaging and putting out a clear idea of what the West stands for, especially here in Europe, where there's a sense of skirting around issues and not trying to get involved in this debate. So, for example, with this whole recently, when that poor girl from Qataf in Saudi Arabia was you know, not just a victim of gang rape, but then imprisoned and then sentenced to 200 lashes, there was silence across the West and across the Muslim world. Now, where were the Muslim voices in the West saying, how dare you do this in the name of my faith? Where was the West in stating that Saudi Arabia can't continue to get away with its medieval barbaric outlook? Unless the West is a lot more assertive, then it doesn't empower normal Muslims to come up and make a stand. And one of the reasons that someone like myself and others increasingly so, people like Majid Nawaz and others out there have come out and gone out against extremism, all guns blazing, is because we had a Prime Minister, Tony Blair, who had no fear in stating the enemy for what it was. He mentioned quite openly Islamism, Wahhabism, ideology, a perverted sense of religion, and that mindset. It was putting that out in the public discourse that forced people like me then to say, well, actually, we might dislike this guy's politics on certain issues, but he's got this one right. Mm. Now, when politicians of major European countries pussyfoot around the issue and are afraid of sort of treading on eggshells, then you continue to allow for the extremists within the Muslim community to assert their sense of superiority and their self-declared representative tendencies. So it's, you know, it's about holding an open, dynamic, transparent discussion without fear of avoiding key issues.
Okay. I'm going to, I've got a couple of questions from my colleagues. I'm going to look at these and come back and just have a few more questions for you. So take a drink of water and we'll try to finish close to 11:30.
Give me a couple of minutes.
I know, this
is, Good. I was gonna stop and ask you this anyway. Yeah. This is it. It's good, isn't it? It's intense though. I don't think I can push it much more than 10 minutes. Right. Exactly, yeah. What? Did I do that? I'm just a parrot, you know? Did I really say that? All right. Hi.
Okay. Yes. Just a couple more questions. All right. So,
how's it going so far? Does it make sense?
I think it's terrific. Yeah, it's terrific. And what we, you know, we have an incredible luxury of an hour of radio. So we will edit this down and I will be able to give people facts and, you know, script in so that they can hear what you're saying and have some context for it. But then we'll also be able to put the whole interview out. And we have an astonishing number of people who will podcast a 90-minute conversation about real important things. So I think it's wonderful. Yeah, so just a couple...
Let's hope it works. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, it is a trend, and I know that some in the British press have criticized this, that, you know, to use or to take former extremists or even former Muslims to become experts who can explain the phenomenon of extremism to the West. And I know that you have not had an easy ride, and I wonder, you know, how would you describe the pitfalls that you've come across in your role now as a high-profile critic of extremism, and do you feel that people are trying to turn you into something that you're not?
I've been careful not to be exploited by certain quarters, but it's when so-called mainstream Muslim organizations constantly deny that there is an extremism problem, and that's been going on for the last 10 years, then people like myself have no duty, have no option but to come up and say, well, actually, there is an extremism problem, and here are the details, just in case you've missed it. Mm. It's not a comfortable position to be in, because the far left doesn't like this, because the far left thinks it gives credence to the centre-right and the arguments they've been making. But for me, it's not about, you know, appeasing the far left or appeasing the far right. It's about getting our house, the Muslim house, in order so that we can stand up and become a dynamic community that's not a burden but an asset to the West. And as I said earlier, that we fix it here in the Muslim West, we can then help the Muslim East by... You know, every time I travel in the Middle East, in cities such as Riyadh, Jeddah, Cairo, Damascus, people repeatedly ask, and these are young people who aren't haters of America. There's a love-hate relationship in that they wear Western clothes, they watch American right. television, they play American games on computers, and yet they've got a problem with key Western ideas when it comes to liberty, security, plurality, and so on. Now, when I worked with the British Council, it was an immense privilege to try to be able to explain to them, look, I am a Muslim, I was born and raised in Britain, and this is how I see it. And often it helps them sort of have a different approach towards the West. One of the things that I could always throw to them was to say, look, America's not just full of non-Muslims as you hear it in your media. America is also home to millions of Muslims. How do you come to terms with that? It helps people look at it differently. That's why I think it's vital that people such as myself who've lived in the Arab world, who've gone through the extremist experience in Britain, who are now on the other side and see Islam to be a totally different thing than we saw it then. I mean, it's almost like a religious and human duty for us to speak out. And if by doing so we upset people who are on the far left and people who are on the far right, well, you know, I'm sorry, but we've got to do what we're doing.
And, you know, many people will ask someone like you or other Muslims, and we've spent some time on this today, you know, what is it that draws Muslims to violence? But I want to ask you the converse question, you know, from your experience. This would also be the story of someone like Malcolm X, who became a mainstream moderate Muslim late in his life after he encountered traditional Islam, Islamic spirituality. Right. You know, what is it conversely about Islam or the Quran or the life of Muhammad that you find, you know, redemptive, not just an antidote to extremism, but that I sense really galvanizes you as a human being now, as well as a public figure?
There are so many examples from the life of the Prophet that one could bring forward. I mean, there was an incident when, you know, at the time of the Prophet, young girls who were born to families were always buried because they were considered to be a sense of shame. And one of his companions came up to him and said that in the past I buried my daughter, and as I was burying her, she was wiping off the soil from my clothes. And looking back, I feel extremely bad about what I did. Do you think God will ever forgive me? And the Prophet smiled and touched this companion of his and, you know, spoke in Arabic and said that God is most compassionate, most forgiving, and forget that and try to do good for people. But I recently had a baby daughter, and I look at her and those... Thank you. And those memories come back, and not just that particular teaching of the Prophet in terms of, you know, the repeated references in the Quran to God being most forgiving, most compassionate, and that one shouldn't be tired of expecting mercy from God, and one shouldn't expect God not to be merciful and forgiving, and God is as you know, one expects God to be. But also looking at my daughter, I want her to grow up in a world in which she doesn't succumb to the pressures that I succumb to. She doesn't buy the extremist mindset that I ended up buying. So it's just, you know, it's not just looking at the past and finding redemptive lessons within the Quran and within the teaching of the Prophet Muhammad, but also looking to the future and trying to build a future for the next generation.
This notion of Ihsan was important to you as you were coming back to Islam.
I mean, Ihsan is the highest way of being Muslim. In other words, manifesting one's godliness or one's sense of compassion to fellow humans. It's a very high status, and it's something that one can only aspire to and never quite claim that one's mastered. But certainly, I mean, Ihsan is also known as Sufism and has many other sort of pseudonyms, but... without doubt, I mean, it's something that one aspires to, but often it's not something that's easy to attain, especially in the modern world, which has its own problems. But I guess it's something that, you know, whether you've attained it or not, if you're a person of faith, you find out in the next life and not not in this life.
How do you translate Isonic? I know different people use different English words to translate it.
Attaining spiritual excellence.
Mm.
And that's just a stab at it. Mm-hmm. These are spiritual matters, and then leave those to masters such as Sheikh Hamza Yusuf Hansen and T.J. Winter from Cambridge and others. I try not to delve into that. My fight is with people who want to perverse my faith.
Well, this is my last question. I mean, you know, as you think about your baby daughter, I mean, do you worry about how you will raise her to bring together her Muslim sensibility, her Muslim faith with her British identity? How do you think you're going to tackle that with her in the years to come?
That's a very powerful question, a very very important one. I mean, this has been on my mind, not just from the moment she was born, but before that, in that the community that she will be interacting with is not an easy community to interact with as it stands now. So, for example, when my wife and I named her, we gave her a name that worked in both communities. So, for example, in Arabic, her name, Kamila, means someone who's complete and perfect. Translated into English, Camilla, it also works in, you know, English-speaking circles. So it's those things, you know, so that she feels part of both worlds, as I do now, and not part of any particular sectarian community. Muslims aren't a tribal people. Where we always have been inherently humane and outward-looking. In recent years, we've become inward-looking. And if Camilla can grow up and be an outward-looking, compassionate human being and live in a world in which she's not judged because of her gender, she's not part of a Muslim community that comes and says to her that because you're a woman, your testimony in court will only be half that a man's, then I think, you know, 20, 30 years later, we would be successful in developing a Western Islam that's progressive, that's dynamic, that's at home with its surroundings, and can continue to produce people who are part of both traditions and comfortable in being so.
Well, that's great. I think that's your last word. Thank you so much.
Okay.
This was wonderful.
Thank you.
Now, do you know when your book is coming out here in the States?
I think my publishers are talking to their counterparts in the States.
Mm-hmm.
But,
are you with Penguin? Will there be Penguin here as well?
Yeah.
Penguin is my publisher too, so I'm going to try to talk to them. I don't like to interview people on book tour. I know you're coming here on book tour, but I've been through it myself, and you get into a mode of, you know, there's an agenda there, and ideas become less fresh. But I will think about coinciding this in the new year with the publication of your book, or if we do it earlier, you know, letting people know that they can get it on Amazon.co.uk, or that it will be coming out in the States. So,
I think it'll be later than the new year.
Do you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, what have you written on, if you don't mind my asking you?
Sorry?
What have you written on?
I wrote a book.
Sorry, forgive my ignorance.
I wrote a book called Speaking of Faith, which is just about this. Some of my spiritual, you know, my story was being raised Southern Baptist, being raised very religious, and then leaving that. But it's also about this extended conversation with people across traditions. It's kind of a memoir of the conversation as well, and a reflection on religion in our world right now.
So, do you know Karen Armstrong?
Sure, we've had her on the show, and I've been on panels with her, and she's everywhere.
I look it up. I look up your book. I look forward to reading it.
Good. Well, it's really great to make this connection with you, and I hope that maybe our paths will cross again. And we will let you know what's happening with the program. I think we will produce it early in the new year.
And, thank you, Krista.
And then also, you know, if your book is a while coming out here, we can put it on the air again to coincide with that.
Thank you.
All right.
I think it might be a while. It's different. You know how it's like a publisher's.
Oh, I do.
It
it's terrible.
A few months,
All right. So we'll make this work. All right.
Cheers.
Thanks
Thank you
so
very much.
Much.
Yeah. All the best. God
Thank
bless.
You
Thank
too.
You.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.